This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. Linda Cohen here with you. ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is the most common behavioral disorder of childhood, and it's the topic of much research because the ramifications of having this disorder are many, far-reaching, and lasting into adulthood. Well, here with more on all of this is Dr. Stephen Ferrone. He's a distinguished professor of psychiatry at Upstate Medical University, and he spent the better part of his career looking for answers regarding this complex of symptoms. He's here with some updates about what's new in ADHD research. Welcome, Dr. Ferrone. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Let's begin by reminding our listeners what we mean by the term ADHD, Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. What exactly is it?
Okay, so ADHD is defined by the three sets of symptoms: inattention, being distractible, not paying attention in class, not paying attention while you're driving. Hyperactivity, this is the classic sign of the little child running about, climbing on furniture, being overactive. And impulsivity, acting without thinking, the child running into the street to chase a ball, not looking for cars, that sort of thing.
So what's the incidence of this? Where does, in terms of how frequent
we have lots of good information on that. And the most recent collection of maybe 100 studies from around the world tells us the incidence is about 5%. And it's fairly consistent around the world. There's no meaningful geographic variation. So it's 5% in the U.S., 5% in Europe, 5% in Australia.
Do we see any gender bias here? I mean, in other words, do we see it more apt to occur in boys
absolutely,
versus girls?
Absolutely. ADHD is more common in boys. And one technical point is that the gender ratio is of boys to girls in the population is about 3-1. But in clinics, it's higher. It's about sometimes 6-1 to 9-1. And we think that's because boys tend to be more disruptive, and being disruptive gets them referred to treatment, and so they get treated earlier. And the problem with that, of course, is that you have many inattentive girls and also inattentive boys who aren't treated because they're sitting in the classroom not paying attention, but they're not bothering anybody. So nobody says, let's have your doctor check you out to see if you have ADHD. And sometimes they don't get referred until later in life, which is a problem because they miss a lot of school learning and other activities in life that they could do better at if they had been more attentive.
So what exactly, you were mentioning impulsivity and activity and all of this and a lack of attention. What does this begin to look like, and at what, how early can you begin to see that in the developing child?
You can see it fairly early, sometimes as early as preschool. Typically, it's not diagnosed until school age. It depends on how severe it is. The more severe cases tend to onset early. We've certainly had cases where you ask a parent about their ADHD child and they say, he was always different. I knew in the womb he was kicking and he was more active than my other children were. Usually, though, it onsets sometime in childhood. By definition, it has to onset before the age of 12 to be called ADHD by our diagnostic criteria.
First of all, do we know what causes it is the first question.
Cause is a very interesting question, and there's a lot of research on that. ADHD is what we call a complex disorder, no different from other complex disorders in medicine, such as hypertension, which can be caused by having bad genes, being too stressed out, eating the wrong foods. In ADHD, we know now that there are clearly genetic causes. We know that's without a fact.
So there are family histories of this.
No doubt about that. ADHD runs in families, but it's not as if there's one gene that causes ADHD, and if you have the ADHD gene, you've got it. It's not like the breast cancer gene, for example, in some families. If that gene is segregating in the family, you're at high risk to get it because it's there. With ADHD, it's really many, many genes. It's a combination of, we don't know yet. Our latest data suggests it could be as many as hundreds or even thousands of genes that combine, and then combine with environmental risk factors. These environmental risk factors that we know about typically onset very early in life. So, for example, if a mother has a difficult pregnancy, the child has a difficult birth, children who are born at low birth weight have a higher risk for ADHD. So we think that both the genetic and the environmental factors are converging on the brain very early in development and rewiring it in a way that leads to ADHD.
It's interesting because it's always nature-nurture. I mean, I don't think you can point to very many things in life that aren't some factor, because even when you have a genetic predisposition to something, people will say it doesn't necessarily get expressed unless the environment is such to help it get expressed positively or negatively.
That's exactly right. We don't in science, we really don't talk about nature nurture anymore. In fact, the environment affects actually changes your genes. There's a whole field called epigenetics that and when you're stressed out, your gene actually changes because a little chemical attaches to the gene, and the amount of the expression of the gene is actually changes and changes your behavior.
So it's kind of an unnatural separation. The fact is that they're constantly
It's not helpful. It's essentially
So right now, I guess one other point I would ask though is this truly a disorder? Because I think that's been raised in other conversations I've had. Or is it somewhat a reflection of the kind of society or the kind of demands of our current civilization in terms of performance?
In other words, this
need for this kind of attention or this kind of focus, sustaining focus over long periods of time. In other words, in a prior time in history, would we be labeling these individuals as having a disorder, I guess is the question.
Well, good question. Now, the answer is that early in history, we didn't label them, and that was a problem because people had this disorder, but they just weren't getting the diagnosis. So it's like saying someone was having a heart attack and they didn't diagnose heart disease. Is it a real disease? Well, yes, it's still real. It just wasn't diagnosed. In fact, you can go back in the medical literature back into the 19th century, in some cases the 18th century, and find in textbooks descriptions of children who today we would say have ADHD. They didn't call them ADHD. They didn't call them anything. They just, it was unclear what it was, but they were clear descriptions.
They were problematic in some way, though.
There was a German textbook. They describe a child called Fidgety Phil, who clearly had ADHD, wasn't diagnosed. The first report in the medical literature was, I think it was in 1901 in a British journal, where a British physician clearly described an ADHD symptom, which he called something like deficits in moral control. So it's not something that only emerges in modern society. It's been around for quite some time.
And not just because we have a highly demanding environment these days.
Exactly.
So what are some of the, very briefly, actually, if you're just joining us to our listeners, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with researcher and professor of psychiatry, Dr. Stephen Ferrone from Upstate Medical University, and we're talking about ADHD. So what's the best way to help a person? And how early can you get involved in helping?
Well, first of all, the sooner the better. Many parents make the mistake of waiting, thinking that it will get better because they don't like the idea of their child being treated for a psychiatric problem or a psychological problem. So early treatment is better because in a child's life, one of the most important things in the child's life is, number one, that they're learning in school, and number two, that they're integrating well with their peers. Let's imagine a five-year-old child who has symptoms of ADHD. It's causing social difficulties. As they enter first grade, they're not doing so well in their academics. And the parent says, I'm going to wait a few years. Well, that few years is a very long time in the child's life. They become 8 years old. It's about a third of their life now. They've been untreated and in a difficult situation. We have very good treatments. The standard treatments these days are medication, followed by what we call supplementary treatments to deal with issues that are not treated well by medication.
Like what?
So the supplementary treatments for children are typically a behavioral therapy program. If the child's behavior isn't fully controlled, then you teach the parents better techniques for parenting so that they can reward the child's behavior appropriately or punish the child's behavior appropriately so that they get better control.
So that there's more structure, in a sense, in their lives.
And that creates more structure, exactly, because ADHD is, at the core of it, a disorder of self-regulation, the inability. The brain is not able to regulate itself the way the average brain can, and so you need stronger external controls.
So basically, we're continuing to use medication. Is there any blowback with the kinds of medication that's being used these days? Are we over-medicating? What's going on today?
So the word over-medicating is used in two senses. One is that too many children are being medicated, and others that the doses are too high.
Correct.
Usually, if a doctor's doing a good job, the doses won't be too high. There's a standard approach to dosing it, and people have been using, for example, stimulant medications since the 1960s for treating ADHD.
Like something like Ritalin, is that still being used?
Exactly. Ritalin was first approved for the use of behavioral disorders in the 1960s, although I should mention that the ability of stimulants to treat ADHD was discovered in, I think, the 1920s in Rhode Island, actually by accident. The doctor was was giving children stimulants for some other reason at a hospital school in Rhode Island, and the next day the teachers came to him and said, what did you do to these kids? They're so much better. And the kids in the school actually called it the math pill, that it would help them because it helped them focus and do their mathematics.
Wow. So at this point, do you feel that things like behavioral therapies and even things like teaching children to relax, perhaps meditative techniques and all that, is that kind of more just adjunctive, or is it really significant in terms of helping these kids?
Well, I always refer to what the data tell me, what research says. And the research is very clear that the medications have the strongest effect in terms of controlling behavior. No doubt about that. The other, these other methods will help some kids sometimes, but the strength of the effect is much weaker. And that's why the current approach is you get an ADHD medication working, and then you see what else is wrong. After the medication is appropriately dosed, is the child still having problems? And problems in school, you deal with it in school. Problems in the family, you deal with in the family. But the idea that, well, every child should have behavior therapy in the family first, see if that works, the problem there is that some parents are very good parents, and it's not a problem with parenting. They're actually doing a great job with their parenting skills. The child needs the treatment. And the more you delay the treatment, the more the child is exposed to these difficult problems.
If they're on medication, is that for life? Or is it the kind of thing that people do, quote-unquote, grow out of?
About a third of ADHD children will grow out of their ADHD by the time they're young adults. So there is this, we call, age-dependent decline of the disorder. We know this from studies, some of which I've done when I was at Harvard, where we follow children up, we diagnose them in childhood, and then we just periodically take a look at them in adolescence and in adulthood. There are now many of these studies, and when you put them all together in a statistical process, which I did a number of years ago, it shows that about, again, a third remit their symptoms and are doing well. Now, two-thirds still have what we call impairing symptoms of the disorder, and the rule is if you have impairing symptoms of the disorder, you should maintain your treatment.
In the little bit of time we have left, I don't want to run out of time. What's new in terms of research? What have you found that either surprised you or something that would be interesting?
Well, I think there's lots of new data, but some of the more interesting things on one side of ADHD's impairments, there's now very good data that ADHD increases the risk for injuries, both for children and adults.
But this seems to make sense. If you're impulsive, you might just fall off a cliff.
Absolutely.
Jump off a cliff.
Absolutely. And that medication reduces those injuries. So when people are on medication, they have fewer injuries. More worrisome, a very large study from the population of Denmark showed that people with ADHD actually had an increased risk for premature death. It wasn't a huge risk. It's not something I'm saying parents don't worry, your child's not going to drop dead. But because in particular of the accident rate, there's a slight increased risk for ADHD people to die younger than they ought to. On the biological front, we've got some exciting data from our genetic studies where we're finally, after many years, discovering specific genes that we can pin down. So this is one of the genes, one of the many genes that's involved in causing ADHD.
And what's the hope, again, without running out of time, what's the hope in finding these genes? What's the plan?
The hope is that we discover a biological pathway that's new, that we have not linked ADHD before, and then within that pathway there's some target in the cell or in the brain that we can target with the medication that will help treat the disorder.
So you could either turn it off or turn it on.
That would be our ultimate goal, or the ultimate goal really would be prevention.
Right, great. Once again, always fascinating. Thanks so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Stephen Ferrone, Distinguished Professor of Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University and an expert in ADHD. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.